This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Tune in to Shocks of Sheba this Thursday, June 6th at noon as we share an exclusive interview with reggae legend Max Romeo. Again, that's this Thursday, June 6th, Shocks of Sheba with Max Romeo, a KBOO exclusive.
Well, good morning and welcome to Fight the Empire. This is episode 100 of Fight the Empire. My first show was back in, about 4 years ago. And my guest then was Pepe Escobar. And we talked about Balochistan, which is a region in Pakistan, which is right on the Iranian border. And it was, you could consider Balochistan a piece in the new great game because the U.S. Was using it as a kind of a base for terror attacks in Iran. And, well, Pepe Escobar is still writing about what he calls Pipelinistan. That was a term that he coined, Pipelinistan, that oil lines and gas lines are very, very important. They are sort of the basis of a lot of these wars that are going on. And Iran is still the key piece because the basic U.S. strategy is to have these oil and gas pipelines avoid Iran and avoid Russia. In other words, that they get the resources directly to Europe and to the West without going through those so-called enemy countries. And so Pepe Escobar is still writing on this in the Asia Times, which is a wonderful source for news and information. Because the latest article, this is by Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed, and he had an article, it was in the Asia Times of May 30th. Let me tell you a little bit about him, if I can find the information here. He's a British writer, and he has written about, first book that he wrote that came to my attention was a book about the 9/11 bombing, sort of getting behind what was really going on. And it was a very well-reasoned article. He's also the author of The London Bombings, An Independent Inquiry. And his work was used by the coroner's inquiry into the July 7th, 2005 bombings in London. So Nafiz Ahmed wrote this article, and the title of it is UK, that's the United Kingdom, pays price for MI5 courting terror. And he starts out with the discussing the sure, everybody knows about it. The murder of the British soldier in London, in a sort of southeast London neighborhood of Woolwich, where he was run down by a car and then hacked to death by two men who were labeled terrorists. And, well, they were. Although, you know, Glenn Greenwald in his articles would say that this act, you could call it murder, you could call it despicable, horrific, anything you want, but it's not terror, really, because the victim was a soldier. So, in other words, terrorism is defined as killing civilians, killing innocent civilians in furtherance of some political end. So that's why it is not terror. Terrorism is used, it's a word that's thrown around so much, it's really kind of useless. But the soldier's murder and other plots, were, according to Nafiz Ahmed, were incubated by an al-Qaeda-linked group called al-Muhajirun. And these attackers, they were actually on the radar of MI5. MI5 is the Domestic Intelligence Agency in Britain. You might say it's kind of like our FBI. And the al-Muhajirun's emir is a man named Omar Bakri Mohammed. Now, he is now in Lebanon, but he was living in England, and he kind of escaped all kinds of, while all this was going on, he was sort of unscathed. And now he is in Lebanon, and he proclaims that he has what he calls public immunity, and we'll get on to that in a little bit. Meanwhile, the al-Muhajirun continues under sort of a new name, new incarnations. And they are led by Bakri's deputy, a man named Anjem Chaudhary. And the al-Muhajirun was founded in 1996 by Bakri and Chaudhary. Now, one of the two men who have been arrested for the killing of the soldier is a man named Michael Adebolajo. He attended Chaudhary's lectures, and he was apparently tutored by Bakri himself. So he's not, you really can't call him a lone wolf. He has connections. And the same year, three top men were recruited by MI6 to help out in the Balkans. Now, MI6 is the British Overseas Intelligence Agency. You might say they are like the CIA. And let me read you a little bit out of Nafiz's article. This is in 1996, Omar Bakri founded al-Muhajirun with Anjem Chaudhary. According to John Loftus, a former U.S. Army intelligence officer, three senior al-Muhajirun figures at the time, Bakri, Abu Hamza, and Harun Rashid Aswad, had been recruited by MI6 that year to facilitate Islamist activities in the Balkans. You remember the Balkan Wars, where we went to war against Yugoslavia or the remnants of Yugoslavia, mainly Serbia, and Islamists were fighting in that war. Back to the article. The objective was geopolitical expansion, destabilizing former Soviet republics, sidelining Russia, and paving the way for the Trans-Balkan oil pipeline, protected by incoming North Atlantic Treaty Organization peacekeeping bases. This is about America's energy security, said then U.S. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson. It's also about preventing strategic inroads by those who don't share our values. We're trying to move these newly independent countries toward the West. We would like to see them reliant on Western commercial and political interests rather than going another way. We've made a substantial political investment in the Caspian, and it's very important to us that both the pipeline map and the politics come out right. So there you have it, kind of from the horse's mouth, that the object of the Balkan Wars and subsequent wars is to keep control or take control of the oil and gas resources of the Caspian Central Asian area. So in 1998, these three top men, Bakri and the other two, were recruited by MI6 to help out in this Balkan war. We were using them. In 1998, Bakri and Chaudhary, they issued a fatwa declaring war against the U.S. and the U.K. Well, you'd think that would get them some heat, but apparently it didn't. Same year, Bakri got a fax from Osama bin Laden outlining four objectives of jihad, including air hijacking. In 2000, Bakri admits training British jihadists. And he claimed that because he was doing this, that he was sort of got public immunity, whatever that means. He was not prosecuted or hampered for doing his other activities because he was performing a service for the British government in their wars. In 2001, a member of parliament said Bakri's had a private security firm that was training recruits overseas and in the UK. Let me read a little bit from that. Labour Party MP Andrew Dismore told Parliament the following year, about a month after 9/11, that Bakri's private security firm, Sakina Security Services, sends people overseas for jihad training with live arms and ammunition, including training camps in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and even at many different sites in the United Kingdom. Hundreds of Britons were being funneled through such training only to return to the UK, advocating that Whitehall and Downing Street be attacked as, quote, legitimate targets. Though Sakina was raided by the police and shut down, Bakri and Hamza were not even arrested, let alone charged or persecuted. It later emerged that the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation had flagged up the unusual presence of al-Muhajirun activists at Arizona flight schools in the U.S. in the summer preceding 9/11, many of whom had terrorist connections, including one described as a close bin Laden associate. So there's an interesting connection right there. In 2003, two al-Muhajirun members carried out a suicide bombing in Tel Aviv. 2004, there was a plot to plant bombs in the United Kingdom. A cell of 18 was responsible, and mostly AM members. 2005, you had the London subway bombing, the 7/7 bombers. They were AM members too. 2005, an MI5 official told journalist Ron Suskind that Bakri had helped several investigations. Bakri told Suskind, quote, "I like it here. I like the health benefits." He likes living in England because he gets something from, well, what is he giving in return? Later, 2 years later, Bakri is in Tripoli saying that we were able to control the Muslim youth. That's what he was giving Britain in return, that he was able to, in his words, sort of provide a safety valve for angry young Muslims. So what you have is is another great game, just like the one that was played out over 100 years ago in the Middle East and Central Asia. This is what Nafiz Ahmed says about that. Little has changed since the great game in the Balkans. According to Alastair Crook, a former MI6 officer and Middle East advisor to EU foreign policy chief Javier Solana, the Saudis are mobilizing Islamist extremists to service mutual U.S.-Saudi interests. The region-wide strategy involves sponsorship of Salafi jihadists in Syria, Libya, Egypt, Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq. Praising Obama's appropriation of this policy, John Hanna, former advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, rejoiced that the idea was to weaken, this is a quote, to weaken the Iranian mullahs, undermine the Assad regime in Syria, support a successful transition in Egypt, facilitate Libyan ruler Gaddafi's departure, reintegrate Iraq into the Arab fold, and encourage a negotiated solution in Yemen. So there you have outlined what the purpose of this kind of double dealing was. Let's go on with this. Alice, so these Salafi, we might go to, so we have what these Salafi jihadists are up to in those countries. Let's, this is not in the article. This is a statement that General Wesley Clark, who's actually the NATO Supreme Commander in the Balkan Wars, and shortly after 9/11, this is back in the year 2001, shortly after the 9/11 attack, General Wesley Clark visited the Pentagon, and he talked to the old friends, and they told him that the U.S. had a plan to take over or overthrow seven countries in 5 years. And those were Syria, Libya, Egypt, Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq. And the final one was the big prize, Iran. And the end game is the control of oil and gas pipeline routes. Seymour Hersh wrote about the same in 2007 that the George Bush administration and the Saudis had secret operations against Hezbollah in Lebanon and Bashar Assad in Syria. That same year, the Lebanese Daily Star reported that the U.S. is sending $60 million to jihadists. Well, we might ask, did Bakri benefit? He says he's been asked to organize against the Shiites in Lebanon and in Syria and Iran. In 2012, Bakri boasts he's been training fighters on the Syrian border and what he calls the Palestinian side. So what we have this record of double dealing by the same group that has been fingered as being responsible for the killing of the British soldier, but they have largely remained, the leaders have remained untouched because they provide what the British and the U.S. government consider important services in foreign adventures. So what do we make of all this? Well, we might say that the U.S. has been on the same side as Al-Qaeda. You know, this is the prime reason why we are fighting in Afghanistan now and elsewhere in the Middle East to remove Al-Qaeda bases and terrorism generally. And so, but the U.S. has been on the same side as Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. That's where they originated. That was Zbigniew Brzezinski's wonderful idea to get the Soviets to invade Afghanistan and provide them with a kind of a Vietnam of their own. So the U.S. has been on the same side as Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, in the Balkans, in Libya, the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi, and now Syria. Well, do we see a pattern here? From this and from what General Wesley Clark said, this casts some doubt on the origin of the Syrian uprising. The standard story is that the Syrian uprising began with protests in some country towns in Syria, peaceful protests that were really ruthlessly put down by the Syrian government, which led to, step by step, led to what is now a civil war, an armed rebellion and a civil war. That is the standard explanation. And it is true that there were these peaceful protests, and the Syrian government of Bashar Assad put it down murderously, you might say. But what is the origin? Did the U.S. instigate these, or was the U.S. kind of waiting for something to happen and seized the opportunity and jumped on board? Now, that is maybe a question that we will never really get answered, but we do know that the U.S. was in the business of overthrowing the government of Assad, even though we used that same government to torture people we didn't like. And the main well-known victim of that was a Syrian Canadian named Maher Arar, who was a computer guy who was on his way home from a vacation in Syria. This is about 7 or 8 years ago. He was on his way home to Canada from Syria, and the plane landed at JFK Airport in New York to refuel, and he was on board the plane. He didn't leave the plane. He was waiting on the plane, and the FBI came on board, and they arrested him, and they sent him to Syria, where he was kept prisoner and tortured for, I believe, for about a year. He was finally let go. The Syrian authorities told the U.S. that they could find, using their interrogation methods, could find no evidence that he was involved with terrorism. So he was let go, and he is now back in Canada. He has won an apology from the Canadian government, and he's won some money settlement, but the U.S. still refuses to reconsider its actions as far as Arar goes. But we see this pattern where at the same time that the U.S. is plotting the overthrow of the Assad government, we use that same government to torture people that we don't like for one reason or another. Well, like I said before, Iran is the target of all this. Iran has been the target all along. And we've been hearing, you know, besides the nuclear issue, which I don't believe is a real issue at all, but that's for another show sometime. But Iran is a target. We hear a lot about how Iran conducts its elections. You know, right? You know, they are in the middle of a presidential election right now. And they have a way, you know, anybody can sort of apply to be a candidate, but they don't all get to run in the elections. They get vetted. They get scrutinized by a board of I don't know who, by the mullahs. And so some are disqualified. The most recent one was Hashimir Rafsanjani, who is actually one of the leaders of the Iranian Revolution, and he was disqualified, so he is not allowed to run. And we look at that and we say, "Wow, that is not democratic at all. Why should the mullahs decide who is allowed to run in an election?" Which is a good comment. That is true. Well, you might think about how do we vet candidates in this country. If you want to run for president, probably if you're serious, what you got to do is get a lot of money. And so you go where the money is, which might be Wall Street or any other financial center, and you get vetted yourself. You go before a board, a bunch of political investors, and you present your qualifications and tell them what you want to do, and then they decide whether they want to fund your campaign or not. It's not quite as out in the open, as obvious as what they do in Iran. They don't say you can't run. They just say, yeah, go ahead and run. You're just not going to get any of our money. We will throw our money behind somebody else who suits our interests. So in a way, we vet our candidates too. We just don't do it quite out in the open the way the Iranians do. And one thing we should keep in mind is that in all the turmoil that's going on in Syria and other wars in the Middle East, it's kind of a proxy war between, on the one hand, Iran, and on the other hand, the Saudi Arabian Kingdom. Well, when it comes to democracy, we might compare the two. Iran is certainly a very, very imperfect democracy, but they do have elections. They do have street protests. They get ruthlessly put down sometimes. But you have to, judging by all the standards, Iran is closer to being a democracy than Saudi Arabia is. Saudi Arabia is a kingdom. It's ruled by a bunch of princes. I don't know how many there are now, 1,000 or more. And they run the country. There are some kind of municipal elections. Women are not allowed to vote, although that may be changing. Women are not even allowed to drive cars, although that may be changing. So things are changing a little bit in Saudi Arabia, but it certainly is no democracy. And we might just think about that when we compare Saudi Arabia to what's happening in Syria. Another interesting story, this came from the World Socialist website, and they report that the Turkish police have arrested 12 Syrian rebels. from the Al-Nusra Front. This is a Salafi jihadist group that is allied with Saudi Arabia and has also proclaimed allegiance to Al-Qaeda. They're the ones who are the core of the rebel army, the so-called Free Syrian Army. They are apparently the best fighters against the government of Bashar al-Assad. And while the Turkish police, now Turkey is sort of the ally in the struggle against Assad, but still the Turkish police, according to the World Socialist website, which is a pretty reliable service, they arrested 12 al-Nusra operatives and they recovered 4.5 pounds of sarin nerve gas. Now this is one of the big stories in this war, is that the question of, is the Bashar al-Assad government has a store of nerve gas, and the big question is, where is it? Are they using it? They've been accused of using it. A UN report has come out saying that apparently both sides have used it in limited quantities. But now we have this story that the Turkish police arrested these 12 al-Nusra fighters, and they recovered 4.5 pounds of sarin nerve gas. I would guess that that is enough to kill an awful lot of people. Now, this was reported in the Turkish press, but not here, that you may be hearing this for the very first time. Now, why is that? You know, if anybody sees it in the New York Times or the Washington Post or any other U.S. newspaper, I wish you would let me know. But this is a very important story. Another story that has been unreported in here by the mainstream press is that Bashar al-Assad is gaining support in Syria. And the main reason being that the Syrians, who are sort of in the middle, are so fed up with these jihadists supported by al-Qaeda that they are throwing their support to Bashar al-Assad as sort of a lesser evil. Now, that story comes from the conservative World Tribune. So maybe if you might want to check that out a little bit, but I will report it for what it is. That has been reported elsewhere, that al-Assad seems to be gaining strength in his struggle with these rebels. Point to make is that the Syrian uprising began in areas of the countryside that were really hard hit by drought, which is a result of global climate change. And the Syrian government has been kind of shortchanging the rural population in favor of businessmen and business interests in the cities. So that's where the Syrian uprising began. And we can expect more of that. There was just a story in Egypt is going really down the tubes because of food riots, food shortages. And the reason is the cheap oil is gone. Farming is becoming more and more difficult because of that. And you can expect more food riots in the future that will topple more governments. And it's time for governments, you know, the civilized world to do something about this global climate change instead of what is going on now, trying to use it for its own nefarious ends. So with that, I will end this and stay tuned.
And good morning from KBOO Portland, just a minute before 10 o'clock. Thanks to Per Fogring and another Fight the Empire today. Coming up in about 15 minutes on Flashpoints, today they present an update on the military whistleblower trial of Bradley Manning with civil rights attorney Bill Simpich, courtroom artist Jay Rudin, and journalist Norman Solomon. We also get an update on sectarian violence, which continues to grow in Iraq, with more than 1,000 people killed in May. And then at 11 on Between the Covers, host Sarika Mehta interviews Filipina writer Marivi Sullivan about her new novel, The Mango Bride. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, host Emma Jackson Ford, Patricia Welch, and Obie Hill interview legendary author Maya Angelou about Mom and Me and Mom, her book about her relationship with her mother. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today. Stick around. Up next, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.
Dance companies and orchestras around the world are celebrating the 100th anniversary of Igor Stravinsky's masterpiece, The Rite of Spring. Here in Portland, new choreography to Stravinsky's score will be performed by the Agnieszka Laska Dancers in collaboration with the PSU Orchestra under the direction of Ken Selden. The performance of The Rite of Spring will take place Friday, June 7th at 8 p.m. at Lincoln Hall on the Portland State University campus. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, June 6th, 2013, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM,